It's the Tully Ringy Legal Power Hour on 810 WGY.
Well, you're listening to the Tully Ringy Legal Power Hour. I'm Barbara King, here tonight substituting in for Matt. Our show is here each Sunday in our new time slot at 7 p.m. to give our listeners insight on the legal and political issues happening locally and across the country. So in addition to listening on your radio, we are broadcasting around the world on WGY.com. Visit our show site at TullyRinkyShow.com for podcasts of our previous shows. Well, last week we talked about preparing for a divorce and how the attorney-client relationship works. And this week we're going to go a step further and walk you through the beginning stages of the actual trial process straight through to the end. So joining me tonight is Tully Ringy partner and family and matrimonial law attorney and litigator, Maria Tabano. Maria's been practicing litigation and family law in the Capital Region for over 15 years. In addition to my own family law background, we're going to provide a full perspective of the litigation process with a focus on divorce actions, specifically why it's important your attorney knows how to litigate and the nuts and bolts of what goes on at trial. If you have any questions for us throughout the show, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY or press star WGY on your cell phone. Well, thank you for joining me tonight, Maria. Good to have you here.
Oh, thank you for having me here. It's a pleasure.
Let me start with a very basic question, and that is, what is a litigator?
A litigator is essentially an attorney who is going to go into court and who's going to actually try the issues that are involved in any matrimonial matter or some other matter, and who's going to present evidence to the court, and who isn't afraid to advance your position in front of a judge or even in front of a jury. Most attorneys aren't really litigators. They'll advance your position and they'll make efforts to settle, but they won't step foot in a courtroom and actually pick a jury or try any of the cases that you feel need a decision by a judge.
All right. Well, if you and I were talking earlier about the statistics of the number of matrimonial cases that actually don't go to trial and settle, and we agreed in our experience it's about 90%. So why is it important for someone to get a litigator for their divorce action?
Well, the reason to get a litigator for divorce action is because although 90% of the cases will typically settle before trial, you always have to prepare to do battle, and you always want to hire a lawyer who will actually walk into court and try your issues, because although the goal is to attempt to settle a matrimonial matter in the best interest of the clients, that isn't always possible. So you want to make sure that you hire an attorney who is willing to go ahead and litigate your issues, because most attorneys will try to settle cases for you, but they may not necessarily want to try the case. And one of the reasons why you want a litigator is because you want to make sure that your matrimonial matter or even family law matter is prepared in such a way that if you have to have a trial on the issues that you want to advance before a judge, that that attorney is going to be willing to go ahead and litigate those issues, because some attorneys won't do that. And you want to make sure that your attorney is going to prepare your case as though every single issue is going to be tried before a jury or before a judge.
All right, so let's say we have someone who's being represented right now by an attorney, and they discover that this lawyer really doesn't have litigation background, isn't prepared to take the case to trial, maybe, you know, for whatever reason isn't comfortable with that. What, if any, pitfall is there in switching attorneys at that point?
Well, the problem with switching attorney at that point in the pitfalls is that the attorney who originally had your case probably did not do their due diligence and make every effort to advance your position. They may have failed in some discovery part of the case. They may have failed to ask for documents. And all your new attorney is doing is damage control, and they're stuck with a case that was not adequately prepared for a trial.
Okay. Well, we have a caller, Alex from Rotterdam. Alex, you're on the radio show. What's your question?
Yes, Ms. King, I just have a question. You all are talking about divorce, and I just have a question leading up to even marriage. When two couples get, when they agree to have a prenuptial, doesn't that almost give them the mindset like, okay, we're pretty much going to be set for divorce? I mean, isn't that just kind of putting them in the direction of saying, hey, we're going to have a divorce most likely?
That, you know, Alex, that's an excellent question. We're planning on doing a whole show on prenuptials probably in the spring. But Maria, your take on that. You and I hear that all the time.
I do hear that all the time. And you're not really, when you're signing a prenup, you're not really saying to the other person, hey, I'm preparing to divorce you down the road. What you're really doing is you're protecting those assets that you know to be yours before you're even thinking about marrying this person. And if the person is really interested in you and marrying you, I don't think they would have a problem with putting pen to paper and saying, look, I understand that you have all of these assets, and I'm interested in you keeping those assets that you brought into the marriage. So while some people may think that you're setting it up for divorce, you're really avoiding the arguments down the road in the event that things do go awry in the relationship. So nobody should be offended by having to sign an agreement if they acknowledge that you came into the marriage with particular assets. You're just really avoiding a big battle down the road, and it shouldn't really hinder your opportunity to marry that person that you really want to be with.
And thanks for calling, Alex. I do understand his perspective. We should get into that in more depth in another show, because there are a lot of philosophical approaches to doing these as well. Before Alex called, though, you were telling me about some of the things that the prior attorney may not have done to tee the case up, so to speak, for trial, if that's necessary. Talk to our listeners a little bit about what is called discovery. What is it, and what does it do, and why is it important?
Discovery is important because that is the pretrial phase of a lawsuit in which each party can request documents and other evidence from the other party, or can compel production of evidence by using subpoenas or other discovery devices. And that is essentially your opportunity to obtain any type of financial information from your spouse.
Like what? What kind of stuff would you want?
Like credit card statements, bank statements.
What are you looking for, Maria?
Well, you're really looking for where all the assets are located, the value of the assets at the time that you filed for divorce. You're looking really to trace every asset that your spouse has. You're not always aware of what assets your spouse has, depending on how involved you are in the finances. But you want bank records, you want deposit slips, you want anything that you can possibly get to track the assets and the liabilities that were incurred during the marriage.
You want to see if your spouse is charging Victoria's Secrets and perhaps you didn't get that for Christmas?
Exactly. You want to know if your husband or wife has a paramour, and whether they're committing marital waste by buying that Fredericks of Hollywood paraphernalia for their spouse, or if they're gambling away assets, or they're drinking away their assets. So you want to be able to determine that by looking at whatever documents, financial documents you can from your spouse.
So someone comes to you with a case that is not settled. It's getting to the trial phase. You pick it up from another attorney who's done the work before you. What if this discovery you're talking about wasn't done properly, or in some cases you and I have seen really wasn't done at all? What's the problem there?
If it hasn't been done properly, or it hasn't been done at all, then you do have a problem. You have the problem of doing damage control. More times than not, if you're heading to trial, you're stuck with what the other attorney did for you. And you may be stuck with going to trial being completely unprepared, and there's not much you can do about that. Perhaps if you do have enough time, you can pick up the pieces where the other attorney dropped the ball. But that's why it's important to make sure that you hire the right attorney in the beginning, who's willing to advance discovery positions and advance you to trial. Because if the mistakes are done, you're stuck. You're the one paying the price, and your previous attorney walks away.
Well, now when we talk about a litigator, trials are what we call jury trials or non-jury trials, bench trials. Now, why do you think it would be important, or maybe not important, for someone going through a matrimonial case to hire a litigator who's had jury experience?
Well, the reason to hire an attorney that has jury experience is because you may want to, in most jurisdictions, you have to prove and establish the grounds for your divorce in order for you to obtain one in New York State. And a lot of times, you may want a jury to decide the issue of grounds. And the reason that you may want a jury is because a jury may be more sympathetic about a bad marriage.
I'm just going to interrupt a minute. You said the issue of grounds. I don't want to assume all our listeners know what you're talking about.
The grounds, what I mean when I say grounds is, in New York State, you, in order for you to get a divorce, you have to have a reason, a basis to get a divorce. We're not a no-fault state. We do not recognize irreconcilable differences. So in order for you to get a divorce, you have to either establish and prove acts of cruel and inhuman treatment. You have to establish constructive abandonment, which is the failure to have sex for a period of a year. You have to establish a regular abandonment, meaning that your spouse vacated the residence for a period of a year with no intent to return. And there are other ones as well. And in order for you to get a divorce in New York State, if your husband or wife is not willing to consent to your ability to get a divorce, you'll have to establish your right and your entitlement to get a divorce.
You have to prove it to
a
court.
You have to prove it to a court. And if you don't want to prove it to a judge, per se, you may want to prove it to a jury.
Okay. Now, what's the benefit of, and when you say a jury, we're talking a jury of six people from your neighborhood or your locale.
Yep.
Why would you want to put your story in front of six strangers as opposed to a judge?
Right. Aside from the humiliating factor, the reason that you'd want to advance your position in front of a jury is because you may find that a jury of your peers would be more sympathetic about a bad marriage and thus more likely to be flexible regarding the domestic relations requirements than perhaps a judge. So if you have a case that is not as strong as you would like it to be for grounds, you may have a benefit in front of a jury of actually being awarded a divorce, where you may not be awarded a divorce if the judge were to preside over the grounds portion of your matrimonial matter.
And you made a good point. It could be somewhat humiliating, not just for the person who's suing, but the person who's defending, to have this, you know, dirty laundry, so to speak, aired. And I think this comes back to our discussion about why it's important to have someone who litigates handle these cases. Knowing the judge, you and I know that there are some judges in the Capital Region that will take the issue of giving a divorce on grounds a lot more strictly than other judges. In other words, some judges may grant them on what we consider to be looser, less established grounds, and there are other judges that take it very, very seriously, and you can almost count on what's going to fly and what isn't.
Absolutely. The first thing that I do when I speak with a matrimonial litigant is I always want to know what county they're in.
Yes.
Because depending on the county, I will know whether there's going to be a very strict application of the domestic relations law, or whether they're going to be construed very loosely. And then I'll know how to prepare my case for a potential trial based on the particular jurisdiction where the action is venued. I'll need to prepare a little differently if I know that the judge is going to be much stricter with my client.
And that also plays into advising your client in terms of settlement. If you have a case where, you know, the grounds may be hard to prove, and we may have a judge assigned who's one of our stricter judges, you're going to counsel your client a little bit differently on the risks of winning, losing, and settling the case. How would you counsel them?
Well, if I know that my client's allegations on the grounds issue is kind of sketchy, and I'm in a situation where the judge may not give my client a divorce, I'll tell them that, you know, you need to maybe settle this matter, give up on a few issues, and then, you know, maybe we can prevail on a few issues and give up on a few issues.
Okay, thanks, Maria. Well, we'd like to hear from you tonight. If you have a question, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY or *WGY on your cell phones. And if you have questions but can't join us tonight, don't forget that we can be reached all week at the Tully Rinke offices, 518-218-7100. When we're back, we'll talk about those fun terms we throw around all the time, like hearsay, objection sustained, and Maria will help us understand them.
One of the worst experiences you can go through is to be charged with a DWI. But with the experienced attorneys from Tully Rinke on your side, you can be confident that your lawyer will fiercely fight to protect your rights and get you the best possible outcome. Call Tully Rinke, 518-218-7100, or visit TullyLegal.com. Tully Rinke, PLLC, 441 New Carner Road, Albany, New York. And the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour, Sunday nights at 7 on WGY. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome.
You've worked hard to acquire your wealth. Let us help you keep it. Hi, I'm Abigail Doolittle, Portfolio Manager at Johnson Illington Advisors. Johnson Illington is a money management firm that provides very conservative and disciplined portfolio management services. Our main goal at Johnson Illington is to preserve and enhance your wealth. We have a highly experienced team led by nationally known investment veteran and economist Hugh Johnson. Visit our website at johnson-illington.com. Johnson Illington Advisors on Broadway in Albany.
A traffic ticket is not a simple matter, and simply paying a traffic ticket might not be your best option. Just because you were issued a ticket doesn't mean you're guilty. The experienced attorneys at Tully Rinke have handled thousands of traffic and speeding tickets in New York. Call Tully Rinke, 518-218-7100, or visit TullyLegal.com. Tully Rinke, PLLC, 441 New Carner Road, Albany, New York. And the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour, Sunday nights at 7 on WGY. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome.
All right, Integral One Network Solutions. Tell me what they do again.
Well, they worked with us to design our new computer network. That's really made a difference. Helps us run our business better. They monitor everything 24/7 to keep it running smoothly. And they manage it all, so I don't have to hire an IT guy.
So when I hire Integral One, they manage my network so I can manage my business. Talk about peace of mind.
Integral One Network Solutions, online at integral1.net. That's integral1.net, 464-4014.
Welcome back to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Barbara King, one of Tully Rinke's family and matrimonial law attorneys. With me is another member of the firm's family law department, attorney Maria Tabano. Tonight, we're talking about the divorce litigation process. If you have questions about how this affects you, give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY. And feel free to check us out online anytime at TullyLegal.com. Okay, Maria, we were talking about using a litigator and going to trial with cases. There's all kinds of terms that people hear and don't really understand the definition of. I want to keep it a little bit simple, but hearsay. What the heck is hearsay?
Hearsay is one of those misunderstood concepts. What hearsay is testimony given by a witness who tells not what he or she knows personally, but what others have said, which is therefore dependent on the credibility of someone other than the witness.
So if I'm testifying and I say, my brother told me he saw Maria steal the pencil.
That's hearsay.
Because my brother's not here saying it.
Right. Exactly. Your brother, right. That's a good way of saying it. Your brother isn't here saying it. And in order to test the credibility of that particular statement, your brother should be on the witness stand accusing me of stealing that pencil.
And what's the benefit of him actually coming to court? I mean, let's say there's no dispute. He said it. Why does he have to come to court and say he said it if even the other side admits he said it?
Because you have to test the credibility of that particular witness who is making the observation or who is making the statement. And the opposing side is entitled to do that. They're entitled to question that person to make sure that the observations were accurate, to make sure that the retelling of that incident is accurate. And they're entitled to that absolutely by questioning that particular witness. And they're not forced to rely upon what you said your brother said.
So, and that's what we refer to as cross-examination.
Cross-examination, exactly.
So we want to make sure that my brother doesn't wear Coke bottle thick eyeglasses and didn't happen to leave them home that day and see somebody who
exactly, or see somebody that looked like me.
Okay. Now, what I'd like you to do is walk us through the non-jury trial process. And even starting with, you know, terms like plaintiff and defendant, you and I live this stuff every day. We don't want to assume that everybody understands the terminology. So walk us through a non-jury trial process.
Okay. You have, in a non-jury trial process, you have what's termed a plaintiff. And the plaintiff is the person who commences the action for divorce or whatever action. And the plaintiff is the individual who carries the burden of proof on whatever issues that party wants to advance. And then you have the defendant, who is essentially there to defend against whatever allegations the plaintiff is going to make, and they only carry the burden of proof on those issues that they themselves want to advance in the context of the suit brought by the plaintiff.
All right. And the pretrial preparation, you and I were talking about how important it was to get subpoenas and witnesses and things. When a case is ready for trial, what do we presume has been done?
When a case is ready for trial, in my cases, I presume and I make sure that this is accurate with respect to my cases, is I make sure that I've served all the discovery that I want to serve. I make sure that I get all the responses that I need to get in order to advance my client's position, whether it's documentary proof or any kind of testimonial evidence that I need. And what I do is I will also, even though I've received certain things in discovery, I will also serve subpoenas so that I can obtain certified banking records, certified pension statements, any kind of financial documents that I want to produce into evidence to advance my client's right to whatever assets they're entitled to.
As long as it's relevant to the case.
As long as it's relevant to the case. You certainly don't want to waste your client's time, your client's money and your time subpoenaing things that have absolutely no bearing on the issues that you want to advance at trial.
So if someone's suing for breach of a contract, they had a contract to sell me something and they didn't deliver, I don't have to worry that they're going to get my medical records.
Right. No, your medical records are not germane to a contract action unless, of course, you're going to make the claim that you were not of sound mind when you entered into the contract.
Okay.
Aside from that, no one's going to get your medical records in a contract-based claim.
All right. And we talked about the importance of what I call coming to battle fully armed. With those percentage of cases that don't settle, when you approach the court with your case, why is it important? Obviously, you want to advance your client's position, but is this overkill? Do we have lawyers that are just doing this work because they're billing for the work, or how necessary is it really?
It's absolutely necessary, because the problem that you have is you always have to prepare your case as though it's not going to be settled and it's going to be tried. And the attorney that walks into court on the day of trial, who is completely unprepared and thinks the case is going to settle, is going to be the side that settles out of sheer necessity because they can't go forward. So that gives the other side an unfair advantage over the other client, because while one attorney is incredibly prepared, the other one is not. So they may have a settlement rammed down their throat that they would not otherwise want, in which case, if they were prepared, they may be able to get a more favorable settlement if the case were to settle. So you always want to be what I call, I always want to go to court armed and dangerous.
Okay. And inevitably, the client pays the price for the unprepared attorney.
Client pays the price in many ways by an unprepared attorney.
All right. So now we've got all discovery ready and we've walked into the courthouse the day of trial. Judge takes the bench. What happens next?
After the judge takes the bench, there are motions that can be made, either motions to preclude testimony or motions to preclude certain evidence that may not have been disclosed to you in the discovery process. And then once those preliminary motions are made, then each side gets to make an opening statement. And what that means, and the plaintiff goes first, of course, because the plaintiff carries the burden, so they would make their opening statement, the attorney would. And the attorney would at that point basically tell their client's story. This is my client's story. This is what we hope to prove. And at the end of our case, once we've proven these facts, this is what I hope to have achieved, and this is what I'm hoping the court would order.
So you're sort of creating, you're telling the judge where you want him to go.
Yes, I'm telling the judge what I'm going to prove and where I want him to go. The one thing that you don't want to do in your opening statement is you don't want to overpromise and then fail to deliver, because then the judge is constantly looking for you to deliver on the promise, because the court will look for you to deliver on what you've said in your opening statement. And if you don't, it's kind of like a flag for the judge, like they haven't proved this, and it detracts from what you have proven.
It undercuts the case.
Exactly.
All right, so the opening statement's done. You said the plaintiff goes first, makes their statement. The defendant goes second. Who testifies first?
Well, it really all depends. Most attorneys will try to put their plaintiff on first. I really try to, sometimes I like to put my plaintiff on last, and I may call the defendant first to testify.
You would actually call the other side.
Yes, I would try to take them off guard, and I would call the other side first so that I could try to elicit some favorable testimony from the defendant before I start putting on some of my other witnesses. And usually it takes them off guard. It's not expected. And I can get some information out of that person right out of the gate.
And if you have an attorney representing that defendant who is not an experienced litigator, it's highly likely they never even warned their client that Maria may call you to the witness stand.
Exactly.
It's a bit unnerving.
Right. They either did not warn the person, they didn't expect it, and sometimes they're not even sure if it's a proper approach to take. So they're not sure what to really do. Is this allowed? Is it not allowed? So you really want someone experienced on your side.
All right, so we've got your client on the witness stand, and there's a stenographer there taking down everything they say. We call that the direct examination, and what you and I refer to as friendly fire.
Exactly.
What's the reason? I mean, look, the judge has read the papers. He or she's been involved in the case. Your client's just up there telling the same story all over again. What's the purpose?
The purpose of the direct examination is so the court can assess the credibility of your client. They can actually look at your client's demeanor, how your client presents. It's a way for the court to really listen to the inflections in the client's voice, how they're telling the story, the emotion behind the story. Because a lot of times these cases come down to his word against hers. So mm-hmm. The judge really wants to assess the credibility of your witness. I mean, anything looks good on paper. Mm-hmm. Then it comes down to how does your client present? Do they present well or do they not present well? Are they crazy? Are they telling a credible, logical, rational story?
Even down to how they dress.
How they dress, if they come in, you know, dressed appropriately. The judge really looks at everything about how that client presents and you know, how they're testifying.
Do they fidget?
Do they stammer?
Do they
look at someone cross-eyed? Every expression on their face is analyzed. So you have to really coach your client on how the proper courtroom decorum.
Right. And when we get into talking later about cross-examination, what I want to remember to bring up is talking about why you don't want to necessarily beat someone up on cross-examination, because you can make them a more sympathetic character and sort of undercut your case.
Right. You really have to have a handle on the type of witness that you have. If on direct examination you notice that the client is doing well, you really have to gauge your cross-examination based on what you see.
Okay, great. We're going into the news now. When we come back, we'll talk about settling your case.
Fox News Radio, I'm Karen Riegel, in front of 500,000 on the National Mall in the nation's capital.
I stand here today as hopeful as ever that the United States of America will endure, that it will prevail, that the dream of our founders will live on in our time.
President-elect Barack Obama speaking at an inauguration concert. Fox News Radio's Jeff Manasso was there.
People were just happy, and they were waving their hands and clapping, and it just kind of soaking it in, and it really is an historic moment, and it's one of those stories that you're going to tell your grandchildren about, and just to be here to witness this was really an unbelievable thing.
The president-elect will take the oath of office on Tuesday, and the Arizona Cardinals are going to the Super Bowl.
The reason that we won is because of our fans, and we're just excited that we get a chance to go to the Super Bowl.
Coach Ken Wisenhunt on Fox Sports. Fox News, we report, you decide.
810 WGY, Storm Team Forecast.
With low pressure developing off the New England coast, that is where the heavier the snowfall is going to stay from Maine down into eastern Massachusetts. But still some leftover snow showers here through the rest of the night. We'll settle back to 19 by daybreak. Light snow showers, mostly cloudy for your Monday, near 30. The colder weather gets back in here, but we get rid of the snow Tuesday and Wednesday, low and mid-20s. I'm meteorologist Michael Palmer from the Weather Channel with the 810 WGY Storm Team Forecast.
Are you contemplating a separation or divorce? Are you contesting the custody of your children? You have the right to receive effective legal advice that restores your peace of mind. The experienced attorneys at Tully Rinke can guide, counsel, and help you understand your choices. Call Tully Rinke, 518-218-7100, or visit TullyLegal.com. Tully Rinke PLLC, 441 New Carner Road, Albany, New York. And the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour, Sunday nights at 7 on WGY. Prior results do not guarantee a similar outcome.
Usually, a mortgage company's sole focus is property, but first-rate funding is centered on people, not property. Whether you're buying a home or struggling with your current adjustable-rate mortgage, first-rate funding will give you the same amazing personal service. First-rate funding, New Carner Road, Albany, and Broadway, Saratoga Springs. Don't wait. Call today, 452-4700, and please go online, firstratefunding.net, and see how they can help you today. Registered mortgage broker, New York State Banking Department. Mortgage loans arranged with third-party providers.
Pets aren't just animals. They're companions and often members of the family. Unfortunately, pets are not always treated with the care they deserve. Animal cruelty and neglect are sadly a reality. Detecting and reporting abuse are the most important steps in bringing animal cruelty to an end. The Schenectady County Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, SPCA, is a nonprofit volunteer organization that investigates complaints of animal cruelty. Our volunteers donate their time and energy because they believe in our mission to protect animals. We are not funded. We rely exclusively on public donations. You can help with a tax-deductible donation by calling 518-755-9517 or visit our website, SchenectadySPCA.org. Or if you'd like to join the Schenectady SPCA as a volunteer, again the number 518-755-9517. Or on the web, SchenectadySPCA.org.
Thanks for coming back to us. If you're a first-time listener, you're listening to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Barbara King, in for our usual host, Matt Tully. Our show comes to you each Sunday in our new time slot at 7 p.m. when attorneys from the law firm of Tully Rinke give insight into the legal issues that matter most to you. And tonight we're talking about the divorce and litigation process. We're broadcasting around the planet on WGY.com. Joining me tonight is Tully Rinke family and matrimonial attorney Maria Tabano. So if you have any questions for either Maria or me, just give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY. Maria, just before the news break, we were talking about having the plaintiff get on the stand and tell his or her story. So your client's gotten up there and told his story. What's the purpose of bringing in other witnesses?
The purpose of bringing in other witnesses is to bolster the testimony of your client and also to bring another viewpoint into the litigation. A witness may know something that your client knows, but they've observed it, they know it better. So you want to bring in witnesses who are going to verify certain documents, who are going to verify certain things that your client has already testified to, or they may be the only witness to something that perhaps the defendant did that your client wasn't a party to. So you want to bring in other witnesses who are going to add something to the litigation.
So it sort of breaks that he said, she said balance.
Exactly. It breaks that up.
Now, what about bringing in relatives or close friends? How effective is that? I mean, let's face it, it's your mother who's testifying. Of course, she's going to say Maria's wonderful and didn't do anything wrong.
Right. Sometimes sometimes it's good and sometimes it isn't. Really, the testimony of relatives is pretty much self-serving, and it doesn't always go in as well as you think it's going to go in terms of their testimony, because they may be over-emotional, they overstress things that are simply not important, they have their own agenda, so it's not always good to parade 30 or 40 family and friends before a judge. A judge, that's never appreciated.
Well, that actually was my next question. I mean, do you really need, I've got 90 witnesses, they only have 89, so I win.
No, you don't need, you can win with just your own client's testimony or just maybe one witness. It's not the more evidence you have and the more people who are willing to testify on your behalf, the more you win. You want to pick the witnesses who are really going to advance your client's position in the most positive way. You don't need 5 or 6 or even 20 people to do that. You can do that with 1 or 2 witnesses.
It's really very much like putting on a play without simplifying the process. Each person that takes the stage or takes the witness chair has to be effective and have a purpose,
yeah,
right?
They all have a role, they all have a purpose, and they have their part to play and nothing more.
Good. Well, after the direct examination is done, what happens next? Your client has gotten on and told his or her story, gotten it off the chest, and you and I know sometimes that's all they really need is to get it said. What is the purpose of cross-examination?
The purpose of cross-examination is essentially to interrogate the witness and to elicit favorable facts from that witness, also to impeach their credibility of... to impeach the credibility of the witness who just testified. And the other thing, too, is you want to try to lessen the weight of any unfavorable testimony that witness advanced in the direct examination. So it's really you're going to try to beat up on that witness.
So the other side's going to come and question your client,
right.
Try and prove that he didn't see things the way he thought he did or that he's lying.
Or he's lying, right. Test his credibility, essentially.
And is there ever any real surprise? I mean, it's a little bit dated, but there's still Perry Mason reruns, and we've all seen the shows. And, you know, boy, they just break down on the stand under cross-examination. And, you know, really, in your many years of experience, do you see that much?
No, you never really have that true Perry Mason moment. You may have some flattering moments, some award-winning moments, but never a Perry Mason earth-shattering, I confess moments.
And generally, why doesn't that happen?
It doesn't happen because there are no surprises. There should be no surprises when you go in to litigate. You already know what the other side has. If you've done discovery, you each know what the other side, what documents the other side has, what witnesses the other side has. You're not allowed to hide something if it's been asked for. So there really should never be a surprise at the time of trial. You're not going to have a Perry Mason, you know, stellar moment.
And that does sort of play into your experience and my experience, why so many cases do settle. I mean, if I know what you've got and you know what I have, you know, I have a client who used to call it opening the kimono.
Yeah.
We've seen each other's set of discovery and issues. We're more apt to want to settle this case, right?
Exactly. Exactly. If I know what you have and you know what I have, there's no reason why a case shouldn't settle. And that's why most cases do settle, because it's a matter of, okay, here is the pie. We've all seen it. And, you know, how are we now going to split that pie? And most of the time, settlements fall apart, not because I don't know what you have or you don't know what I have, but it's how are we going to split what we
have.
Good
point. Good point. Well, why, in your experience, or what can you tell to educate our listeners as to why they're better off with a settlement? I mean, you know, once someone wants to sue or they get invested in suing and they've paid the attorney and put in all that time and money, you now have to tell them it's in their best interest to settle. And why would that be?
Well, the reason it's best for them to settle is because when you put your issues in front of a judge or a jury, they don't know your case as well as you do, first of all. And second of all, they're never going to craft a settlement that is going to be pleasing to both parties. So if you craft a settlement yourself, you're more apt to abide by the settlement, and you're more apt to accept the settlement because it's something that you've decided that you can accept and you can live with. But when a judge makes a decision for you, it's not always something that you can live with. No one is ever happy with a judge's decision because neither party came up with the settlement. Neither party made the decision. So they're never happy with a decision from a judge.
And I like the term you used. It's something they know they can live with, because the reality of matrimonial litigation is there usually are children involved, and they do have to live with each other to raise these children over many, many years.
Exactly. And they have to be able to live with whatever settlements they reach, whether it's with the children, whether it's financial. And a judge isn't going to be living that life for them. So it's best for them to settle.
I've heard it described that attorneys can settle cases with a scalpel and a judge is going to use a hatchet.
Absolutely. Okay. And that's exactly what happens.
All right. So now the plaintiff's case is in. What happens next?
Well, once the plaintiff's case is over, a couple of things can happen. At the close of the plaintiff's case, the defendant can stand up and make a motion for a verdict in their favor if the issue is grounds and they don't think that the plaintiff presented their case properly.
Give our listeners an example of what you're talking about.
Well, let's say the plaintiff put in a case on based on cruel and inhuman treatment, and they didn't carry their burden of proof, and they weren't able to establish their entitlement to a divorce. Well, the defendant's attorney would stand up and move for a directed verdict in their favor based on the failure of proof on the part of the plaintiff.
So the defendant's attorney is basically saying, Judge, I don't even need to put on my case.
Exactly.
Based just on what Maria's client said and the cross-examination I've done, dismiss it outright.
Dismiss it outright. I don't have to do anything because they didn't carry their burden. So as far as we're concerned, I can rest right now, and their case has to be dismissed.
And if that motion is granted, what happens?
If that motion is granted, then there's no divorce, and the parties go on living unhappily ever after.
Okay. And if it's not granted, then what?
If it's not granted, then what happens is now it's the defendant's turn to put on their case. They put on their witnesses, which are subject to cross-examination. Same process as the plaintiff just did.
Okay. Well, now I want to ask you about objections. We've all heard about, you know, your client nudges you, object to that. What does it mean when we talk about objections?
Objections are funny because everyone uses them, and I'm not sure that they all know what they actually mean. But when you use objections, typically what you're doing is you're asking the judge to keep out evidence, whether it's documentary evidence or testimonial evidence, and you're making the objection because you don't want the judge to hear it, you don't want the jury to hear it. So if the attorney stands up and makes an objection and the court sustains the objection, that means that the court is not going to allow that testimony, and that means the objection was heard, and they ruled in favor of the objecting party.
So your client has to shut up, basically.
So the client has to shut up, although clients don't always understand that, and they want to just – they don't care about the objection. They don't even care that it was sustained. They want to tell their story, and they just want to keep talking, and they don't realize that they have to really stop at that point.
And overruled,
if it was overruled, that means that the judge heard your objection and he didn't embrace your opinion regarding the objection, and therefore whatever testimony or documents you're trying to get into evidence, he's going to allow.
Okay. Now, closing arguments. Tell us what those are and what the purpose is. That both cases are in, now we do closing arguments. Who goes first and what's the purpose?
In a closing argument, that's the defendant's opportunity to go first. They go first, and they basically recap for the court all of the testimony that they heard, all of the evidence that was produced, and they draw a picture for the court and ultimately lead the court down the path and to a conclusion that's favorable to their client.
And the plaintiff does the closing argument last?
Plaintiff goes last because the plaintiff is the one who carries the burden of proof. So the plaintiff will go last, and they will do the same thing that the defendant did, essentially draw a roadmap for the court, recapping the evidence, recapping the testimony, and drawing a map for the court to lead to the conclusion that they want.
So, Judge, now that you've heard everything we have to say, here's what we think you ought to do.
This is what we think you ought to do, and this is why.
Okay. Well, it's time for a short break, and when we're back, we'll discuss what happens after the trial and what happens if you don't like the decision. Feel free to give us a call with any of your questions. To reach us, call 1-800-TALK-WGY or press *WGY on your cell. If you don't have a chance to get in touch with us tonight, you can reach us at the Tully Rinke offices all week at 518-218-7100. And if you have something to say about what we're talking about tonight, give us a call, and we'd be more than happy to talk to you.
Have you taken stock of your assets and long-term financial goals? Are there changes in your family or finances? The experienced attorneys at Tully Rinke PLLC can provide estate planning services, including wills, trusts, tax planning, powers of attorney, probate, and long-term care planning. Call Tully Rinke, 518-218-7100, or visit TullyLegal.com. Tully Rinke PLLC, 441 New Carner Road, Albany, New York. And the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour, Sunday nights at 7 on WGY.
You know this isn't the right job for you, but the problem is you don't know what the right job is.
If you're looking for career advice, Careers in Transition LLC can help. Careers in Transition LLC is a career counseling firm that helps you figure out the right job for you. They're not an employment agency, and Dr. Tom Denham is not a headhunter, but they can help you write a better resume, prep for a job interview, and a lot more. Careers in Transition LLC, 11 Computer Drive West in Albany, 366-8451, and online, careersintransition.com.
As a busy working professional, looking good's important to you. No one understands this better than Best Cleaners, the Capital Region's premier garment care provider and dry cleaner. Got a wrinkle in your schedule? Best Cleaners offers pickup and delivery of your dry cleaning right from your home or office, so you don't have to fit one more errand into your busy week. Call 458-BEST and we'll take care of the rest. With three locations in Del Mar, Loudonville, and on the Latham Circle, Best Cleaners. Always look your best. Call 458-BEST. 458-BEST.
If a commercial lease is in your future, listen closely. Conley Associates will provide you with an honest, unbiased comparison of available office space. Unlike the competition, Conley Associates works directly with you, the tenant, finding your business the ideal location at the best terms. Best of all, leave the landlords to us, because we represent tenants only. Secure your new office space with a tenants-only approach from Conley Associates. Landlords need not apply. Conley Associates, 463-5500.
We're back to the Tully Rinke Legal Power Hour. I'm Barbara King. Joining me tonight is family law attorney Maria Tabano. Find out more about our show at WGY.com or visit TullyLegal.com to see what else we can do for your legal needs. Well, we've still got a little bit of time left to answer your questions on the divorce litigation process, so give us a call at 1-800-TALK-WGY. And we have on the line here Paul from Saratoga with a question about divorce. Paul, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello, Paul. What's your question?
I've been divorced for a little over 6 years now, and we have two children, and we have joint equal custody with the children, a week on and a week off. However, I spend about 70% of the time with the children, at this point, I want to file for primary custody based on having the children more. Do I have a shot of getting primary custody, or is that not?
Well, hold on. We'll turn that over to Attorney Tabano here.
Okay.
Maria?
So you have 1 week on, 1 week off, and you want to petition for more time because they're with you most of the time?
Yes.
I got to be honest with you. When you have a joint shared physical custody arrangement, in order for you to really take more time away from the mother, you're going to need more than just the fact that perhaps the children spend just a little bit more time with you.
The fact I kept the primary residence and they're still they live, or you know, they go to school in the same district. She moved out of the district. Would those things weigh in my favor? And does that add up to maybe having a case, or?
I mean, to be perfectly honest, I don't think that that's a case where you're going to change that particular custodial arrangement. It has to be something more than that. I'm sure that all of that stuff was taken into consideration when you guys came up with the 1 week on, 1 week off. And typically a court isn't going to change that arrangement unless there is something a little more devastating that perhaps the mother did that would warrant a custodial change in your favor. I mean, that's 1 week on, 1 week off is very favorable, and it's really hard to turn that around unless it's something a little more egregious that was done by the mom.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
All right, thanks
for
calling, Paul. We have another caller.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
We have Leon from calling all the way from Queens about a discovery question. And Leon, you're on the air. What's your question?
Oh, thank you. What happens if the other party refuses to say what's available, what she has?
They won't turn over discovery, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay, Maria, what happens?
Well, if your spouse or the other side won't turn over discovery, then what your attorney has to do is they have to move to compel the disclosure of that particular information that they're refusing to disclose to you. And if they, your motion to compel is granted, there are certain penalties that come along with their failure to disclose information to you. So that's what your attorney should do, is move to compel. And to the extent that that information is not disclosed, then you would move for inferences in your favor with respect to any issues that deal with that particular discovery issue.
For example, he could move to have the information not introduced at trial.
Right, the information not introduced at the trial. Like, so if she tries to produce information on that issue that she won't disclose, you can move to preclude any introduction of evidence with respect to that issue that you're looking for disclosure on.
Does that answer your question, Leon?
Well, it was very hard to hear, but what if she refuses everything? In other words, if she won't go to court, she won't say what she has, she just won't anything. Just says no. Won't answer the phone.
Does she have an attorney, Leon?
Yes, I believe so.
All right. Well, then your attorney and her attorney, even if she won't communicate, they can communicate. And they should be talking to each other. And they know the rules of civil litigation and discovery. And then her attorney and your attorney should be exchanging information. And if it's not happening, as Maria said, your lawyer's got certain rights that he can advance for you by bringing applications to the judge.
And the other,
it's been 7 years, but okay.
Well, the other thing you can do, Leon, is you can also have your attorney request a conference with the judge, at which point you guys can discuss whatever discovery issues that you have with your spouse. And the judge can make decisions at that discovery conference.
Thank you for calling, Leon. Maria, before the break, you had mentioned that the plaintiff goes first in the closing argument to the court because they carry the burden of proof. And most of us, when we hear about the burden of proof, we're thinking beyond a reasonable doubt, that criminal standard that all the great novels and movies are written about. What's the standard of proof in matrimonial litigation, which is what we call civil litigation? Is it the same or different?
No, it's different. It's a preponderance of the evidence, which means that the evidence which is of greater weight or more convincing than the evidence which is offered in opposition to it. So in a criminal matter, you have the scales of justice where one scale literally like hits the floor, and that's beyond a reasonable doubt. In a civil matter, it's where the scales are tipped just a little more in your favor.
So 51% could win.
51% could win.
Okay. Well, now the trial's done. What can you do afterwards? Is there any final, you know, the trial's done and you think, wow, you know, there was a great argument I could have made and I didn't make. You know, trial's a lot of pressure. There's a lot going on. Is there any last opportunity?
Yes, at the conclusion of a matrimonial trial, you do have the opportunity, if you want to take the opportunity, to submit, to have final submissions either in the form of a memorandum of law or findings of facts and conclusions of law, where you could, if there's a complex legal issue that you want the court to fully understand, you may brief that for the court. If there are some facts that you want to highlight for the court, you'll ask for the opportunity to submit some final findings of facts so that you can highlight those areas for the court that you think are most favorable to your client.
And throw in law and case decisions to convince the judge once again.
Right. Anything and everything that you have to do to convince the court that you're right. The only thing that you can't do in final submissions is produce any evidence that you did not produce at the trial.
If you forgot it, it's
out. If you forgot it, you're done.
Well, that leads me into talking to you about appeals a little bit in the time we have left. You know, inevitably, as you said, a judge renders a decision. It's rare. Either side is completely happy with it. The decision comes down. Your client doesn't like it. What are his options?
If a decision comes down that your client doesn't like, you can either try to resolve those issues with the other attorney and see if you can try to settle the matter post-trial, or...
But you're working from a position of lack of power then.
Right. You have no power at that point. So the only other way for you to get any recourse is for you to take an appeal to the appellate division. And in order for you to do that, you have to file a notice of appeal. And that happens, you have to take that and file that notice of appeal within 30 days after you've been served with the adverse decision.
That's pretty fast.
That's pretty fast. Yeah, you file it. You have to file it within the 30-day period, but then you actually have 9 months to perfect that appeal. So if you have a decision that you're not happy with, you should at the very least file the notice of appeal showing your intent to appeal, and then you have 9 months to really perfect it.
Sometimes just the event of filing an appeal could bring the parties back to the bargaining table. Have you experienced that?
Yes, yes. If you file your intent, your notice to appeal, and there are some issues that could really go either way, sometimes that will prompt the other, because appeals are incredibly lengthy and very, very costly. So sometimes in order to avoid the cost of that further litigation, attorneys and clients will come together and try to resolve those appellate issues so that they don't have to incur the additional expense of going to the appellate division. And like I said, it's very costly and a very lengthy process.
Well, what's so costly about the appeal process?
Well, it's costly because let's say you have a 5-day trial. You have to order the transcript of that trial, and you have to gather all of the exhibits that went into that trial. And the transcript itself and gathering the exhibits, that could cost you several thousand dollars. And then once you collect all the transcripts and the evidence, you have to package it in a record on appeal. And the process of packaging it is also very costly. So by the time you've incurred expenses and you've written briefs, that could cost you $10,000 to $15,000. It's very costly. It could cost you as much as the litigation, the original litigation.
And needless to say, you're talking almost a year between filing the notice of appeal, 30 days, up to 9 months to perfect, then getting into argue the appeal, and then waiting for a decision. These are families with their lives potentially on hold for an entire year.
Exactly. And people are they don't like the litigation process because it took them a year or so to get to the trial. Now it's going to take them yet another year.
Okay, good. Well, that's it for us this Sunday. There actually was a lot more we wanted to get to. Thank you for joining us, Maria.
Thank you.
And if you didn't have a chance to reach us this evening, we can be found all week at the Tully Rinke offices at 518-218-7100. Thank you again for listening. We'll be here on WGY each Sunday in our new time slot at 7 p.m.